The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, it's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here. Welcome to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. This is just a note to say that if you are hearing this, then you are not currently part of my membership programme and will only be hearing the first part of each show. In order to access full episodes of the Tudor History and Travel Show, you will need to become a member of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England, via the link in the description associated with this podcast. Welcome, dear listeners. Today I have headed into central London and actually to the National Portrait Gallery to see the new exhibition, which you are going to be hearing all about in a moment with our expert guest. So, in fact, let's just dive straight in because there's so many treasures to be seen here. I must admit, I haven't been to the National Portrait Gallery since it's reopened. So A, that's very exciting. And B, I've heard some wonderful things about this exhibition. And having just had a very quick tour, I can tell you there are some real gems in the offing for us to find out about. And our expert guide today is Charlotte Bolland. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, welcome to the National Portrait Gallery and to the exhibition.
Yeah, and it's lovely to meet you in person because we have in the past done a podcast about Jane Seymour's portrait after its restoration, but lovely to be here.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, we're standing in this wonderfully cavernous space, as people can probably hear from the acoustics here. And before we talk about this exhibition, first of all, perhaps you could just introduce folks and tell them what you do here at the National Portrait Gallery.
So I'm the senior curator for research and 16th century collections at the National Portrait Gallery. And we are a very kind of chronological institution. So I'm very specific in that I hand over to my colleague, the 17th century curator, the death of Elizabeth I, 1603, then who knows what happens. It's the future from my perspective. So a very, very specific role looking after the Tudor portraits.
Well, I can totally understand that. I'm pretty much the same myself when it comes to history. So 1604, what's that?
We'll be getting on with the podcast very shortly, but I just wanted to let you know that due to unforeseen circumstances, a spot has become available on this September's Rise and Fall of Anne Boleyn tour, which runs from the 2nd to the 8th of September. That's this year, so just in a couple of months' time. So if you are looking for a fantastic Tudor adventure, we have an action-packed itinerary that takes us to see some wonderful places behind the scenes, off the usual Tudor trail, and with a whole smorgasbord of Tudor experts to enrich our knowledge of Tudor history. Now, if you're interested in finding out more, then you need to head to Simply Tudor Tours at www.simplytudortours.com and search for our Rise and Fall of Anne Boleyn tour, which you'll find in the main menu for all further information. But if you are seriously interested in booking your place, then I recommend that you email me directly, sarah@thetudortravelguide.com, for further information on costings and to, of course, express your interest. So that's all I wanted to say on that front. Of course, we are still booking for our Anne and Elizabeth tour, Mother Daughters, Traitors, Queens, which runs in May 2024. Again, you'll find out all the information from Simply Tudor Tours website. All right, well, that's all I wanted to say. So let's go back to the podcast.
Now, I mentioned that the National Portrait Gallery has just reopened after quite
a long period of closure. So could you just tell us broadly what's been going on here?
So we've just had our 1 year anniversary since reopening with this kind of transformational project that's really kind of reviewed the whole way we displayed the collection, new spaces, and had a great exciting opening last summer. And so we now have this wonderful kind of large space to work in. And this is the first historic exhibition that we've had since reopening. So it was an incredibly exciting opportunity to get the chance to think about the kind of Queens, not only in their own time in a very sort of 16th century space, but to use the much larger spaces of the new galleries to think about the kind of afterlives and the representation of the Queens and how we kind of meet them in the 21st century.
So is that the main thrust of this exhibition, to get people to think about how we see people according to the lens of the time in which we live?
Exactly, because one of the things when we think about the Queens, there are so many layers to kind of peel back, thinking about all that we know from history books, but also from novels, plays, opera, films, all those kind of different voices and sources in our head when we think about the Queens. And so I wanted to kind of explore that a bit, to think with visitors about where these stories come from and how we tell stories about the Queens, before then kind of going back in time 500 years to the 16th century to kind of meet the Queens on their own terms through their portraits and possessions, but also thinking about the stories that they told about themselves. Kind of, they've been held up over time as kind of certain sort of stereotypes of kind of female behavior, female life experience. What were the stories that they used to kind of shape their own narratives in the 16th century?
Interesting stuff. Is this a particular area of interest of yours? I'm wondering what stimulated this as the primary perspective or lens that you wanted to sort of start with for this exhibition.
Well, one of the things that I'm sort of aware of in curating the Tudor portraits of the collection is the sort of popularity and interest in the Tudor period, which is wonderful, and the kind of how the Queens are so widely recognised and often kind of, you know, aware of visitors in the spaces, making a kind of beeline for Anne Boleyn and thinking about the way in which she is presented. And that was something that I really, you know, kind of find fascinating. And because at the Portrait Gallery, we have this very sort of interesting remit of we're thinking about portraiture, but also biography. And in the kind of transformation sort of project of all the thinking we were doing about the collection, we also really want to think about storytelling. And this all kind of came together very strongly in the question of the lives of the six queens and their kind of commemoration and the way in which they've been transformed into kind of popular icons over time.
Okay, well, we're going to get straight into that in a moment, because, of course, everybody knows the recent phenomenon of six, I suppose, and that I know we're going to see and maybe talk a little bit about that. Now, the first space we're standing in, I'm sort of got the imposing figure of King Henry VIII staring down at us with his, you know, his famous pose, his legs askance and his arms almost resting on his hips. And then behind us, really impactful series of black and white portraits, imaginings, I guess, of what those queens would have looked like. What's this space trying to introduce us to?
Exactly. Well, it's really kind of setting up that kind of the concept of the exhibition, because one of the things I was really wrestling with, of course, is what to do with Henry in this story, because the focus is the six women and their stories, but you can't cut him out of their stories completely. Their position as queen kind of comes from their marriages to him, and in the structure of court in the 16th century, he was the star around which everything else orbited. He was the centre of the universe. And so I kind of wanted to you know, be upfront about that. So he's there in the opening of the exhibition in the Walker Art Gallery's fabulous full-length portrait from Holbein's workshop. But the other thing that's so interesting about that painting is its role in portraiture and storytelling, because the image of Henry that's so kind of familiar and has been used as a means of telling the stories of the Tudor court since the early 17th century. There's a fabulous chronicle of King Henry VIII's reign that has the title When You See Me, You Know Me, and has the same kind of woodcut of that pose that's so familiar from Henry. So in a way, because of this portrait, Henry has become a kind of fixed point in the stories. By contrast, the queens and the kind of vagaries around some of their portraits are much more sort of liminal figures who have different layers of storytelling have kind of built up around them. And so kind of having that contrast with Hiroshi Sugimoto's portraits of the queens. Now, these are wonderful images, and they've got this incredible uncanny quality, because you look at them and at first glance sort of think, what are these? Who are these people? You know, are they wearing lots of makeup? Have they just stepped into a photographic studio? But they're actually photographs of waxworks from Madame Tussauds. And that kind of playing with the sort of lifelike qualities of portraiture is so interesting, because you think you know these women, but actually they're sort of imaginings of them, they're kind of reproductions of them, and that these are some of the things we need to kind of peel back.
Yes, unpick. Yeah, it's very symbolic of what you're actually trying to get people to think
exactly,
about.
Exactly, yes.
So where do we need to go to maybe think a little bit more about how the queens have been portrayed over time, and maybe some of the different lenses? Because I am sort of familiar with this, particularly with some podcasting I did up in Scotland when we were talking about Mary, Queen of Scots. And it suddenly occurred to me, looking at all her portraits, that she looked uncannily like Queen Victoria in practical. And I sort of thought, you know, maybe there's a lens that people are seeing it through. And I know there was a big project up actually in Scotland about kind of the memorialisation of Mary, Queen of Scots. But so I suppose we're talking about the equivalent here with the six wives. So what do we need to look at next?
Exactly. Well, thinking about the kind of role that portraiture has played in the way these women are remembered, and particularly their kind of group identity. So that sort of the six wives and the very famous rhyme of divorce, beheaded, died, divorce, beheaded, survived. And the way the queens have come to be remembered by the moment at which they were, to use Shakespeare's term, unqueened, the end of their relationship to Henry, but just that sort of one moment in their life, one word kind of summing up their entire biography.
Yeah, right.
And what's interesting is that a kind of a sort of parallel sort of reduction has happened in portraiture, because there's been an interest to sort of illustrate this rhyme and their stories with group portraits, and which has created a sort of homogenized iconography, that the minute you reproduce the queens and want to form that, them into a group, be it for kind of stamps or kind of novelty teacup, it then erases the specificity of the source portrait, because there's a huge difference as to whether something is a miniature that or a full-length panel on oil on panel painting, that these were created for very different functions, very different purposes, who commissioned them, who saw them. But if they all get reduced to the same kind of crop of the Queen's head in a row, that individuality is erased, and it's sort of just as reductive as the rhyme in a way. So wanting to kind of help, you know, show visitors to think about that way that portraiture has been used, and that sometimes in that quest to kind of find a likeness, actually you can get more distance from the Queen if you don't think about the kind of the original object, that the reproduction can actually kind of blur the story.
So how do you think that the six wives have been portrayed through the generations, through the centuries? If you were I'm going to try and ask you to be quite reductive, because I suppose there's a huge story in that, but you know, if you were to try and condense it down from their unqueening, what happened?
Well, in that I will turn to the words of Hilary Mantel, who could always put things much more precisely and wonderfully. And she spoke in her Wreath Lectures in 2017 about how some stories bear retelling, they compel retelling, about the last days of Anne Boleyn, and that there's something in these women's stories that people have wanted to kind of return to again and again, because there is enough information for the facts, and the facts are so sort of outlandish almost of the kind of sequence of events. But there is also the space to try and understand the kind of human emotions of it. And I think that's part of the fascination people have with this period, is that it's also kind of messily human. These grand kind of issues of state and of religion are kind of unfolding, but you have all these personal relationships that are on, that are kind of trapped within it and shaping it as well. And so people have kind of returned to that. And there's this great bridging between fact and fiction that has, you know, been, again, going on for centuries, where the historical imagination is used to kind of fill in some of the gaps. And of course, that when historians are telling the stories of Queen, they're saying more about the time that they're in than necessarily about the 16th century. So we have in the exhibition displays of copies of Agnes Strickland's Lives of the Queens of England, which have this, they're very kind of empathetic to the Queen's situation, but there is this sort of Victorian sensibility of the kind of grand moral lesson that kind of Catherine Howard might present. And so I'm sort of fully aware that in engaging with this subject and writing my own words about it, that I will be, you know, judged in 20th, you know, this is the very 21st century kind of moment of thinking about these queens. And it is not the last word. Their stories continue to be kind of retold.
And how do you think we are telling their stories, say, vis-a-vis the Victorian period, where it was all about family and morals and so on? And women certainly had still had their place in the home. Where are we now, do you think?
I think there is that kind of desire to speak about the Queen's kind of agency and their individuality and their own networks and patronage and the way that they performed as queens. So, yes, exactly that role of how they used their position as queen rather than necessarily their sort of just their position in the home and that kind of moment.
Trials.
Exactly.
Yes, okay. And do you, I know we're stood next to the room here, which perhaps encapsulates some of the things we've been talking about. Do you have a favourite piece in here that perhaps illustrates what we've just been talking about, and perhaps we could go and have a quick look at it?
Well, I think in this context, I kind of have to talk about costumes, and we have a selection in the show, but the costume for Catherine of Aragon from the musical Six. And that it's really interesting to think of, you know, how stories sort of change over time, and that the huge success and popularity of Six the musical has really had a kind of impact in the way the queens are remembered. Because in the sort of distant past of 2015, if you asked somebody about the Six Wives to name, who could you name? Anne Boleyn probably had the kind of strongest name recognition, then Catherine of Aragon, and then it might all get a bit kind of confused. And now, because of the way they are, their stories are told through the musical, there is a huge audience of people who know exactly who Catherine Howard is and know exactly who Anne of Cleves is. And so that's really kind of fascinating. And one of the things of why I was so excited to be able to include this in the exhibition.
And can I say this?
Yes, of course.
We should just say we are standing in front of a mannequin dressed a la Catherine of Aragon, a rather stunning and very modern interpretation.
Exactly. And thinking about the way in which kind of designers kind of construct the characters of the queen through costume. So in this, this was designed by Gabriella Slade, kind of amazing award-winning designs. And what's fascinating is she was using Tudor portraiture as a reference. So she's spoken about how the kind of square neckline and the sort of grid patterns referencing stained glass, the kind of large amounts of gold, thinking about armour, but also as filtered through the lens of Beyoncé.
Yeah,
so you've got this kind of cultural sort of mashup moment. But it is, so there are Tudor elements, but it is not a kind of recreation of a portrait. And one of the things I wonder about that that's so interesting is that the kind of concept of Six the musical, that the queens are kind of performing in concert, you know, and that they are, they can speak for themselves. They each have a microphone, they sing their own songs. So where a portrait is used to, you know, in the kind of famous term, to make the absent present, you don't need that for the performers in the Six musical because you're meeting the queens. They can speak for themselves. And so that idea of needing a very literal 16th century presentation to be able to go, ooh, which queen is this? You don't need that because they have their own voices. And I think that sort of playing on the role of portraiture in the kind of construction of character and the freedom you have if the queens can speak for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it is so interesting, this point about the fact that you literally cannot separate your interpretation of the storytelling from the time you live in. It's impossible, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And that kind of awareness. And that's one of the things to think about that I'd love kind of visitors to think about and coming to the exhibition, because obviously I'm a kind of passionate advocate and fascinated in history, but the sort of space there is in history, because you're always kind of having to construct a story, even when you're being incredibly kind of factual to only ever things that are kind of known about. From the vast sea of information, the writer is selecting information to kind of construct a story. And so all our kind of thoughts of our own time and our own biases will, of course, be built into that. And that's fine. And you just need to be aware of it, that in any attempt to kind of seek an authoritative final word that is actually, you know, nailed on, we know this is all that happened, is never going to be the case.
It's interesting, isn't it, to think what's going to come next? What's the next 100 years hold in store for the six wives when we're all gone?
Exactly.
Able to hear, we're just changing room here at the moment, and I'm surrounded by some portraiture, all later portraiture of the Queen's, right?
Exactly. And so one of the other things that I was keen to sort of unpick or share with visitors in this exhibition is the challenging story of the Queen's kind of commemoration through portraiture and what happens to their images after their deaths. And the shift between why some queens are so recognisable and others, their iconographies are so confused. So in this room, we have kind of multiple representations of Anne of Cleves, including an extraordinary copy of Hans Holbein the Younger's half-length portrait from the Louvre by the Impressionist artist Degas.
Yeah. So,
and what's kind of the point of thinking about this is that the reason why Anne of Cleves is so recognisable is because her portrait has long been celebrated as a work of art, that she transitioned into sort of being the king's sister, so there was no need to kind of aggressively kind of destroy her imagery. And then once, as Holbein was such a celebrated artist, it entered private collections that, including the Earl of Arundel's in the 17th century. So we have etchings by Holler of copies of this Anne of Cleves that then get reproduced and reproduced and reproduced. And so in this painting by Degas, it's sort of nothing to do with Anne of Cleves. It's about Degas looking at Holbein. And so that is why she is so sort of familiar, but oddly, it doesn't actually help us with her story and her individuality. It's about the kind of art. Whereas by contrast, the queens whose images have become confused are kind of encapsulated in a series of engravings we have from a late 17th, early 18th century French history of Britain. And that idea I was saying about the desire to collect the queens into sets. And so when writing a narrative history, it was like, we need to have images of all the queens. And great effort, you know, great lengths were gone to try and source accurate images, and kind of, you know, research was undertaken. But they had the challenge with Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard that nobody had sort of preserved the crucial window kind of 50 years after your death is when you need to be remembered. And as they seem to have been kind of deliberately forgotten, and perhaps their images were deliberately destroyed, there is this gap. For Anne Boleyn, intriguingly, that her kind of reputation is restored slightly through her daughter Elizabeth, that in the late 16th century, suddenly there's a moment where actually you do need to celebrate Anne Boleyn as Henry's wife because Elizabeth has to be legitimate. And so she kind of gets, you know, brought back into the story of English history. Whereas for Catherine Howard, there's no kind of redemption narrative. And so it seems that one of the images that have come to be reproduced widely as Anne Boleyn was again in her descendant, her family possession in the mid-17th century as a collection of Holbeins, and a kind of deliberate decision to turn a Holbein drawing that they owned of a woman in a gable hood to say, right, this is Anne Boleyn. And then that gets reproduced for centuries afterwards. And then also in this set of engravings, you have the question of poor Catherine Parr, who is...
Is this supposed to be Catherine
exactly,
Parr?
Exactly, yes.
I was looking at that thinking, well, that's very Elizabethan for a
exactly,
start.
Yes, yeah, an enormous ruff that she's wearing there. And so the query that you have here... So Catherine Parr was the queen who was most interested in portraiture, commissioned many artists, but of course, because she died so soon after Henry's death, after her marriage to Thomas Seymour, and her daughter died, and she was the sort of peak of her family's representation, that there was no one to kind of do that concerted remembering after her death. And sort of in a kind of tragic irony, that in the Elizabethan period, when artists making print series were looking to commemorate Lady Jane Grey as a kind of Protestant heroine, they sort of latched onto images of Catherine Parr. And so Catherine Parr's paintings kind of survived, but they were all called Lady Jane Grey. She disappeared under the kind of image of her ward. This image is even separate from those kind of Lady Jane Grey ones. And it does look a little bit like a kind of Mary Queen of... like a French imagined Mary Queen of Scots.
It really does, doesn't it? I mean, if it didn't have Catherine Parr, I would be absolutely none the wiser. Particularly as we now have some lovely portraits of her, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, where do we go in our storyline from here?
Well, so now kind of moving back to the 16th century, so kind of armed with the knowledge of how we, you know, why we think the things we think about the queens already, to then kind of come back into the 16th century and to think about the sort of performance of love and storytelling in that context at court. And so in this... Henry VIII has to make a reappearance, and I was so excited to be able to borrow this from Royal Armouries, which is Henry's armour from 1540, so made for celebration of his marriage to Anne of Cleves, or the May Day jousts. And so it was wonderful to be able to include this to think about kind of Henry's physicality, just that sense of, you know, made-to-measure armour shows the way he was a very tall man, a physically imposing man. I did enjoy perhaps the sort of juxtaposition with, which you can see at the kind of end of the vista, of sort of Holbein's image of Henry, the kind of myth of Henry, and then perhaps the more reality.
The reality.
The profile, you can see, you know, the impact of all the weight he'd gained after his jousting injury. But also thinking of Henry as a husband, because one of the things in this exhibition of including Henry is that for all the huge changes that happened during his reign and the impact that they had on English society for centuries, thinking about Henry as a husband, one of those elements that I was think so important is his love of acting and performance as a kind of chivalric knight, being the hero of his own story. And this was the world that the queens had to navigate. This was the language, his language of love, was all about that kind of showing off and telling stories.
I always find it so intimidating to stand in front of this particular set of armour. I always feel like I need to say, sorry, Your Grace. He's quite, and as you say, huge girth there at that time. Goodness gracious. So we, as you say, we're going back in time now to the 16th century, and the way you've organised this is you've got a general room here, which is about the women at court, and then we go into to look at the individual wives and the portraiture and the artefacts associated
with them. Exactly, to see each of the kind of queens in context. So one of the things you will have noticed in the works we've already seen is that this is perhaps the most kind of diverse exhibition the gallery's put on in terms of the range of material we are displaying to kind of tell the stories of the queens. So it's not only paintings and photographs, but as you saw, armour. We have here a tapestry. Later in the sections for each of the queens, kind of musical instrument, amazing metalwork, textiles. So a really kind of, I wanted to share some of the magnificence of the Tudor court to really set the women in context.
And actually, if I could just interject here, because as I say, we did have a quick walk round. I think that's one of the things that just jumped out at me so much. And you've got books, you've got letters, you've got jewellery. I mean, some really rare pieces that I haven't seen. So anyway, I just wanted to emphasise that, because folks, you really need to come and see this. Okay, now we're in this room called Women at Court. What are we trying to do here?
So, yes, I think with this, so we've got an amazing group of portraits by Hans Holbein the Younger, thinking about the kind of people who surrounded the queens and their roles in their stories. So we have two beautiful small portraits from Vienna of servants in the royal court. And of course, the servants were witnesses to all the extraordinary events. Some of them were called to kind of testify. And the also thinking about some of the women in service, such as the Susanna Horenbout and her role with Anne of Cleves. So really important to kind of acknowledge this huge group of people within the court.
And you've got the little miniatures here of Susanna, haven't you? Is that Susanna?
Well, not necessarily. So I unidentified kind of woman that kind of cases have been made for the identification of these portraits, but haven't yet kind of firmly sealed it all down.
They really are beautiful. I presume they were a pair because
Yes, they are husband and wife. And kind of, and I talk about Susanna in the context of the interpretation because that way in which many couples served at court, that often you were kind of, and she was married to people who held roles at court. So that sort of somewhat insular world that people are living in. And then also ladies in waiting. So three portrait drawings by Holbein from the Royal Collection, because, of course, a number of the queens served as ladies-in-waiting to their predecessors, and also their roles in kind of support of the queens, but the risks that came with that. So, of course, Jane Rochford was executed alongside Catherine Howard, and the kind of risks posed to Catherine Parr's ladies-in-waiting when their sort of possessions were searched for heretical books. So the kind of importance of those figures surrounding the queens.
Yes.
So one thing is thinking about the kind of perception of women at the Tudor court through the lens of material culture. And there is, of course, the fabulous resource that is the inventory of Henry VIII's possessions. And I've had so much kind of fun in thinking through that inventory about what it can reveal about biography and the way people lived. But so the paintings are selected here because I wanted to give a sense of the stories of women that the queens lived with. So we have an image of kind of Mary Magdalene reading in court attire, very similar to a work described in the inventory as Mary Magdalene looking on her book, the box standing before her. Then we have an image of Lucretia, the Roman noblewoman who killed herself after rape, and this led to the kind of founding of the Roman Republic. And what's interesting is that in inventories at the time, if you have any paintings at all, you have a Mary Magdalene and Lucretia, that these are the stories that are just everywhere. With Lucretia in particular, it offers that kind of happy mix that has happened to art history for centuries, where you get to have a sort of tragic woman who's a model of chastity, but you can also display her naked. So in Jutta van Kleef's incredible painting from Vienna, so you can see Lucretia's breasts. So it is that sort of contradictory messaging within it. But Henry VIII loved images of Lucretia, so he had a number of paintings of her that Lucretia decorates, kind of metalwork, tapestries, it's just all over the place. And I think that says really interesting things about the perception of female honour at court and the kind of culture that these women are having to navigate. And then finally, this wonderfully unusual image, which maps so closely onto a work described in Henry's inventory of a woman playing upon a lute and an old man holding a glass in one hand and a dead man's head in the other hand. So to translate that into what we're looking at, so you have a woman playing a lute and a man holding a skull and a mirror that reflects the skull. And so it's a kind of, it's a vanitas scene, a sort of memento mori kind of allegory. But really interesting in thinking about music, because music is central to the kind of Henry's court. And that idea of how it, again, perceptions of women and perceptions of kind of appropriate responses and active, that Ben Hebbert's written in the publication really interestingly about how in this period, music was the way to balance the soul, and that you should aspire to a kind of balanced soul. And while it was innately feminine, the kind of classical muses are feminine, men should, of course, get skilled at music to, you know, balance their masculine energy, but that you shouldn't go too far, because if you were too musical, then everything was out of balance. And so Ben kind of argues the case as to whether there is something, particularly in Anne Boleyn's downfall and the arrest of Smeaton, and the men who were arrested with her, particularly also Thomas Wyatt, that if it was trying to make the point that the men around her were too musical, they were too feminine, and therefore Anne, by counterpoint, was too masculine, and if her court is out of balance, then sort of everything could be true.
Yes,
you know,
right.
She's not playing by the rules. It's all plausible.
Interesting.
And one of the things that's so beautiful about this painting of the Mary Magdalene is that during the research for the exhibition, I came to think about how the queens use their kind of name saints. So Catherine of Aragon and Catherine Parr, very much sort of deliberately referencing St. Catherine of Alexandria, Anne Boleyn at her coronation, deliberately referencing St. Anne. Of course, there is no St. Jane. And I think that Jane sort of perhaps adopted Mary Magdalene as her kind of model saint. A bit of a commentary, perhaps, on kind of religious conservatism versus reform, or at least being a deliberate counter to Anne Boleyn, because at this moment in the religious conversations, there was lots of discussion about who is Mary Magdalene, that the conservative presentation of her was a sort of a conflation of a number of Marys from the Bible. And religious reformers were trying to unpick that and go, no, this is the one story of Mary Magdalene. And intriguingly, the story of Mary Magdalene that Jane Seymour chose to include in the pageants that declared her as queen was a much more religiously conservative kind of presentation.
Right.
And when doing research to the exhibition, I was really struck by the fact that in this cup, so it's of a type of kind of genre piece that was produced in relatively large numbers in the Low Countries, you know, kind of for export and sale all over the place. So exactly the type of thing that Henry would be able to acquire. But looking at it, at exactly the moment where you might kind of individualise and make your thing bespoke, there is a bird with rather interesting splayed arms that looks quite like Jane Seymour's phoenix emblem. So I'm thinking, you know, that we can't trace the provenance of this painting because, of course, in inventories, it will always be just, you know, a Mary Magdalene. So trying to kind of specify, it hasn't been possible. That said, you know, a research strand worth kind of pulling at a bit further. But there is a very slim chance that this might be a lot closer to one of the queens than I initially thought.
That's very interesting. Just come into a different part of the exhibition. This is where we start going through the individual rooms associated with each of the queens, and we've got portraiture, as you were saying, we've got books, we've got objects, we've got jewellery. So I think what would be really good to do is to just get an overview of what's the theme for each of these rooms. Obviously, people listening will be very familiar with the story of each of the wives. So maybe your interpretation, what you're trying to say, and perhaps then we could pick either the most interesting or the most unusual, most rare, or your most favourite object to go into a little bit more detail in. So here we are, Catherine of Aragon, beautiful portrait in front of us here.
Exactly. So this moment to kind of meet the queens on their own time, on their own terms. And so each of the sections has a kind of central portrait to kind of meet them and think about their iconographies. And that thing that I was talking about, the sort of specificity of the way in which they're created. And so this image of Catherine of Aragon is so interesting that in kind of portraying her magnificence, its scale suggests it was likely produced as a pair to an image of Henry VIII that we actually have in the National Portrait Gallery's collection, very similar composition. And we know that listed at Baynard's Castle, even after Catherine's death, is a paired portrait of Henry and Catherine. So here she is presented as a kind of individual, but that world of course, the length of her marriage and her in thinking about the construction of her imagery. But so each of the section kind of brings together portraits to think about sort of family networks and close relationships and the sort of key figures. And so with Catherine of Aragon, sort of, oh, so much to talk about. But one of the things to think about was about the, of course, her Catholicism and the kind of religious changes that came about as a result of her of the divorce. But what I wanted to think about here was one kind of just to pull out of the different kinds of objects we have in this exhibition and the way in which twisting the kind of perspective to think about the queens has kind of shaken out some interesting crumbs about other individuals at court. And so what we have here is a copy of The Institution of Christian Marriage, which was a treatise on marriage that the humanist Desiderius Erasmus kind of wrote for Catherine of Aragon. It was a rather long-running project that was kind of running late. And so it actually arrived in 1526, which was incredibly poor timing because it was the moment at which, you know, Catherine did not want to hear about the rationales for divorce in the context of marriage. But what's kind of particularly fascinating, so that sort of says something about, you know, kind of Catherine's patronage, that Erasmus had praised her sort of education and the so her work as a kind of a patron of humanists, that it has on it this book an incredibly intricate and beautifully designed frontispiece by Hans Holbein the Younger, because Holbein was working with Erasmus. It is a reused design, suggesting something about the speed of the kind of the rushed final stages of production, that really showcases Holbein's skill, because it's incredibly innovative in the way that the kind of perspective works, but a slightly jarring juxtaposition of stories. So you have the kind of suicide of Cleopatra in this conversation about marriage. But one of the things that sort of came out is it is inscribed at the bottom. It bears Erasmus's inscription to Catherine of Aragon. So this is the kind of personal, sort of dedicated copy to kind of present to the Queen.
Can you read out what it says?
So Serenissima Anglia Regina, Erasmus Rotterdam, it gives this to you. Yeah. And so, you know, that's the thing of being able to bring kind of handwriting and, you know, people's, the objects that people have touched. And in looking into this, that in 1526, that this is the moment that Holbein comes to England. And in practical terms, the most likely person to have carried a book that Erasmus signed in Basel to London in 1526 is Holbein. And we have so few kind of fragments of the sort of specifics of Holbein's life that these kind of crumbs are really interesting. And I think it says something, you know, maybe about Holbein's reception in England. So he kind of arrives expecting to make, you know, a great splash. Here's this gift from Erasmus about marriage to the Queen. He has access to the kind of highest of the royal court. And then it doesn't perhaps go so well. Yeah. It's not received in quite the same way. Erasmus is left kind of, you know, prodding Thomas More to try and find more about how the book's been received. And it doesn't seem that Holbein received patronage from Catherine, and that he, of course, makes his great splash the following year at the reception for the French ambassadors and the moment when Anne Boleyn kind of takes the stage.
What an amazing... I love seeing that writing there. It's fantastic. Yeah. You can just imagine him in his little study.
Exactly.
Right, being very proud of himself.
And from Holbein's portrait, we can picture his study. We can picture Erasmus was in its study.
Absolutely. Oh, there is just so many. Honestly, I want to talk to you about all the objects, but I guess, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening in, this is why you need to come for yourself, because wherever you turn, you literally won't know where to go next, because there's so many old friends.
Exactly, yes.
Now, we're moving through an archway into Anne Boleyn's section, and here's her beautiful portrait in front of us here, the iconic one with the bee necklace that you will all know and love so well. So introduce us to Anne and her story in here.
Well, one of the things that's intriguing about having this portrait kind of front and centre, so this is the one image that isn't actually contemporary to Anne Boleyn's life. So this is the painting from the National Portrait Gallery's collection, one of the incredibly famous works that we have. And it is, and we've long known this, an Elizabethan image. And one of the things that I think is so sort of intriguing about it is that identifies Anne as wife of Henry, but not as queen. And I think it says something interesting about her commemoration in the Elizabethan period. As I was saying earlier, that her marriage to Henry had to exist because Elizabeth had to be legitimate. But nonetheless, she couldn't be fully rehabilitated to say that, you know, she'd been wrongly executed and be pardoned, because that would mean that Henry had murdered Elizabeth's mother, kind of. So this kind of difficult position that she has, her sort of reputation sits within. And I think it is intriguing in this context, the famous Bee jewel, because we, from the inventories and from the one image of Anne that we have in the exhibition that definitely survives from her reign, which is the famous medal from the British Museum, which has AR. So we know that there's kind of Anna Regina is how she presented herself, or HA, kind of intertwining her initials with Henry. That to have a kind of B image, her Boleyn identity, is perhaps says something more about how the Elizabethans are thinking how to commemorate her and identify her, rather than how she presented herself. Because I think the minute she could be queen, you know, that's the priority of her identity.
Do you think that B has been made up then?
Well, so that I haven't found as yet, and absolutely kind of a research question to follow, that I haven't found a B jewel referenced anywhere, kind of, you know, in the sort of descriptions of things. And that use of your sort of family name. The one person who does do it, of course, famously, is Catherine Parr, and we have a letter written by her, signed by her in the exhibition, and she wrote kind of Catherine the Queen, KP. But I wonder if that's partly about the fact that she's the third Catherine the Queen, and so she's trying to kind of specify, oh, this is me. So she has a kind of more of a reason to justify her Parr identity. Whereas I think, yes, the kind of it, as Anne kind of rises up the social status, how much she presented herself as a Boleyn.
That's a very interesting question, because I often get people saying, do we know what happened to the Boleyn bee necklace? It's an intriguing thought to think that it might never have existed and have been just a play on a style of jewellery. Yeah. Can I ask you your opinion? How close do you think this is to Anne's likeness? Because there are different images of her. There's the Holbein sketch as well, which does look quite different to me anyway.
Yes, it does look quite different. And that's often been one of the things that's counted kind of against the Holbein sketch and people's interpretation of it. But to sort of throw the cat among the pigeons kind of thing, that question of saying that because this is an Elizabethan image, that there's every chance that this isn't actually related to any kind of source image. So we used to catalogue it on the, you know, it used to be assumed thinking, oh, this must be based on a lost portrait made during her time as queen or kind of just before that. And that is a very logical and plausible assumption kind of to make. But at the same time, there is no proof of that. And that kind of question, if you think about, because all the portraits of Anne that survive from the late 16th century are, you know, kind of part of portrait sets. And if you think of the artist having to solve this problem, how are they going to find a portrait of Anne Boleyn? You know, what is their source image going to be? Mm-hmm. And so one kind of hypothesis, and Edward Town at the Yale Center for British Art has been doing lots of research thinking about this painting in particular. You know, does the artist sort of start with an image of Elizabeth and work backwards? Is it like, you know, what are the sort of key, you know, features to then construct an image of Anne? So, it is a real kind of conundrum and fascinating, but that it can't, I don't think it can be assumed that this is definitely relating to a lifetime portrait.
Okay, you really have put the cat amongst the pigeons there. Thank you so much, we love a good cat among the pigeons. Is there any artefact in here that perhaps we would just like to highlight before we move on?
So many treasures, and to say that kind of during the kind of installation of this exhibition, there's an extraordinary moment where kind of boxes, you know, works come out of cases, and the number of times you kind of get chills as things come out. So when I pick things, there are sort of, you know, at least six other things in each room that kind of nearly brought me to tears as they emerged.
You literally have to be one of the luckiest people to be able to handle all of these. I mean, some of us are lucky if we ever get to handle one, let alone all of them.
Oh, I will defer on the handling, that the conservators are the ones doing the touching. I'm admiring from afar.
So what are we looking at here?
So looking at here, the an incredible book of hours, which is speaks wonderfully to that idea of how the queens used sort of stories and exemplars to kind of present their own messages. And so this is the Book of Hours in which Henry and Anne exchange messages. And so Henry wrote an inscription to Anne in French, intriguingly kind of, you know, wanting to reach out to her in her language, as it were. on the, as Christ of the Man of Sorrows, how much she was suffering, he was suffering in his love for Anne. Anne chose to write her couplet, by loving proof, you shall be fine to be to you both loving and kind, on an image of the Annunciation of the Virgin Mary. And so a very kind of, you know, it doesn't take too much to join the dots to the messaging of, I will give you a son. And so that's kind of fascinating choice of, you know, where are you going to write your message? Also, you can see that it's the one page in the book that's been trimmed and Anne's signature has been removed. So she's been kind of erased from the story of this courtship at a subsequent date, which is perhaps part of kind of why the work itself sort of survives. And the you can see why the decision-making of the person who did that, because the illumination is so beautiful. It's an incredibly kind of high-quality book, and it's that, like, oh, I don't want to destroy the whole thing. So if I just trim it a little bit, then it becomes a safe object.
I have never noticed that. Is this the book that's from Hever?
No, this is from the British Library.
Oh, this is the British Library. Yeah. So, I never noticed that being trimmed off before. Mm. How intriguing. The history of the book as well as the... God, that's incredible. It's the afterlife of the book. Okay, well, we need to say goodbye to Anne. Goodbye, Anne. And we're moving on to Jane. Hello, Jane. Again, as in all of these, the first thing you see is the portrait of the lady in question. So there's a couple of portraits of her in here, aren't there?
Exactly. And one of the intriguing things about Jane is that she is sort of very recognisable because her kind of portrait proliferates and her also her visual iconography of her emblems survive. But there is very little trace of her individuality, her kind of the material culture associated with her, no kind of letters, books, inscriptions, all that world, because her rise is so speedy. And then that as she dies so soon after giving birth to Edward, that she is kind of instantly proactively commemorated, both by her family members who want to promote the fact that they are related to the future king. And so as a result, Jane is sort of curiously kind of unknowable, but of nonetheless very recognisable, which this kind of mix. And so in this kind of exquisite painting, that I love the scale of it, and that Jane's portrait is the one that Henry does keep. So listed in his inventory, there is a portrait of Jane with the suggestion, because the way it's paired, that it might have been of a similar kind of small scale. And sort of the kind of emotional sort of resonance of it. It seems that Henry kept lots of Jane's possessions. Her clothing kind of went into storage at Whitehall Palace. And that idea, though, of just perhaps a glimpse of a kind of character of reading into an inventory, that amongst these possessions are described two slips of embroidery, one of a lily pot and one of a falcon and stump. And the lily pot is also associated with the imagery of the Annunciation and the kind of the Virgin. And the falcon stump is, of course, Anne Boleyn's emblem. And I do wonder if this sort of places Jane kind of at Anne's side, kind of embroidering a gift for Anne's lying in, that then gets kind of quietly put aside kind of after Anne has her sort of final miscarriage and Jane starts her sort of meteoric rise. And that idea of the kind of, yes, the getting closer to the humanity of the question.
It sounds like the inventory, I mean, it's a chunky thing, isn't it? But you can buy it online and it sounds like it's a fascinating thing to dip in and out of.
It is, in a way, kind of sort of, you know, for certain kinds of research approaches. So it is just a very, very long list. But when you get into it, it's incredible just the types of things, the range of things to open. So if you have a question of wanting to understand something about Henry's court, the inventory is absolutely worth a kind of moment of diving into it.
I'm just right up close to this oil on panel, about 1540, from the workshop of Hans Holbein the Younger, of Jane Seymour. And I just couldn't. That embroidery, the gold round her headdress is exquisite, isn't
yes, it? Yes, the kind of the skill of it. And this is such a wonderful painting because if it's kind of smaller size and it really draws you in and kind of encourages that incredibly close sort of engagement with it at the details. What's intriguing, and you can see with the comparison of a larger scale version of the portrait that's in the gallery's collection, which is on the kind of wall behind, is the gallery's portrait is unfinished. And so it is missing the kind of gold, intricate gold embroidery in her sleeves, the details of the jewels. And the question of why it is unfinished has sort of been a long thing. And we you know, don't know. We only have the object to work from. And so there's the query of whether it might have been commissioned by the Seymours, and therefore, with the downfall of Edward or Thomas in Edward VI's reign, a bill wasn't going to be paid, and so it just got set aside. But there is also the rather more kind of dramatic possibility of, you know, what might cause you to walk away from a project midway through, that if Holbein dies of plague, you know, you're going to shut up a studio quite quick from that kind of moment.
Could that be the portrait he was working on?
Is that, within his studio? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I'm noticing the jewel round her neck, and then I couldn't help notice in another cabinet a jewel that looks very, very similar. And I thought you was probably, oh, it's just a repro, just to shut up. But no, this is enameled gold, Hessenite garnet, a peridot and sapphire from 1540-1560. So this is a real Tudor. I don't think I've seen one as beautiful as that.
Very sort of sadly, none of the jewels kind of that we know were owned by the Queen's kind of survived.
Yeah.
The things that are listed in the inventory. But the Victoria and Albert Museum has an extraordinary collection. And among this, they have lent two works which are very similar to the jewels that Jane wears in her portrait. So an IHS jewel with diamonds. And yes, this kind of pendant. And I was so excited to be able to include these in the exhibition to give, again, that sense of the magnificence of court, the kind of scale of these jewels and their kind of incredible stones. And also, of course, because through the jewels, a number of the queens kind of inherited the jewels of their predecessors. And so you can see similar jewels appearing in other portraits. So particularly that kind of pendant that is in the portrait of Jane Seymour also appears in the portrait that's probably Catherine Howard. And one thing that I didn't expect, which is you kind of learn about as an exhibition comes together, when you're installing, suddenly the objects start having different conversations with each other. And these two jewels are displayed alongside portraits in miniature of Jane Seymour and Henry Fitzroy. But the way in which miniatures are described in inventories as being kind of part of tablets and part of jewels, suddenly when you see their scale next to examples of jewellery, you're like, oh, this is so plausible. They wouldn't have seemed kind of bulky or out of proportion. They would have fit very naturally within the kind of the types of jewels that the queens were wearing.
Absolutely. And that IHS jewel in diamonds, that is exquisite. I don't suppose we know the provenance of where they came from, do we?
No, that they don't. And IHS jewels were kind of quite popular. So a number of them appear in kind of inventories of Princess Mary's jewels and in possession. So it's, yes, impossible to tie down kind of exactly. But yes, of things that draw the eye, they are wonderful.
Whoever owned that was seriously at the top of Tudor society, whoever it was. Okay, let's move forward. There is a book in here which I know is particularly precious. Do you want to describe it to us?
Yes, so this is really interesting. So it's a copy of the Great Bible, the sort of translation of the Bible into English that was ordered to be present in every parish church. And this copy is from St John's College, Cambridge, and wonderful research has been going on into it, led by Eyal Poleg at Queen Mary University. Because this seems to be a copy ordered by Cromwell himself, printed on vellum in France, so an incredibly luxury presentation copy, and then illuminated kind of in England. What's so fascinating about this is the kind of choices that Cromwell has made to sort of personalise this copy. So you can see a portrait of Cromwell handing the Bible to Henry in the centre at the top of the composition. And that's actually, sort of technical analysis has shown, a sort of portrait in miniature that's been kind of cut out and stuck on to kind of specify Cromwell's involvement. Why I wanted to request to borrow it and include it in the section of Jane Seymour is because of the choice that Cromwell made in the bottom right corner, which in the sort of print that's the kind of source for the composition underneath is a woman with children. And Cromwell's kind of had it overpainted with a woman wearing gold and silver and red, so clearly incredibly regal. And in that kind of colour composition and the gable hood, it does sort of echo Jane Seymour's iconography. By the time this book was published, Jane Seymour had died, but Cromwell is kind of putting together the proposal for Henry to form a kind of new marriage alliance. And that this book and this image is sort of making the case using Jane's memory for the role, to show the role a queen could play in disseminating the word of God, in kind of Cromwell's reforming agenda. So he's kind of using Jane to kind of encourage Henry in that direction.
Wow. I know we haven't got all the time in the world. They look like they're other familiar figures. Do you think there are other actual people from the Tudor court depicted
exactly
on that frontispiece?
Yes, I think so, that there are the kind of research into this is ongoing, because as you can see, that's incredibly detailed images, and unpicking who's who is a tantalizing project on
the to-do list. What great fun that would be. So we now have the lovely Anne of Cleves, mm-hmm. in front of us. So tell us about this particular room. What was the theme that you picked up on for Anne?
So really wanted to think about the kind of different culture that she came from. And so it's wonderful to be able to include some prints of her brother and sister, Wilhelm and Sibylla, by Aldegrever and Cranach. So that just kind of very different court culture that was her world. And to be able to borrow this portrait from St. John's College, Oxford, which is likely the one that was kind of first shown to the English delegation prior to Holbein being sent. And this is the sort of image that they critiqued for Anne's monstrous apparel, and which had sort of prompted the rebuke from the Chancellor of, would you see her naked? Mm-hmm. But in that rebuke, I did kind of wonder if, again, what are the stories that are at play? What, where would that kind of response come from? And I wonder if it's a bit of thinking about the story of the judgment of Paris, of Paris and the kind of golden apple asked to judge between the three goddesses, which is the fairest, and in choosing Venus sets off the events that leads to the Trojan War. Because there is this sort of orangey fruit here in the kind of front of the balustrade that could well be a golden apple, because that idea, it was common kind of iconography in German betrothal imagery, and that idea that whoever holds the golden apple holds all the virtues of the goddesses. So in this, Anne has all the virtues, but in the German kind of iconography, often the goddesses are shown naked. So I think that idea of kind of judging portraits and judging women, and kind of the story of the judgment of Paris, underpins the kind of Chancellor's retort of like, no, are you going to see them naked? No. But that sort of, again, that kind of whole sort of cultural infrastructure that sort of draws on the way we sort of tell stories, and that Anne's story kind of, I think, is about, a mismatch of cultural expectations, and also Henry's kind of fantasy as a king. And that's one thing that was lovely to be able to draw out, because one of the kind of great joys of thinking about an exhibition as opposed to sort of writing a book is you're thinking about how to tell a story through objects, through works, and to bring sort of things into conversation with each other. And so in this space, I was able to borrow from the British Library two maps. One shows the English proposed route for Anne of Cleves to come to England.
Can you just point out what we're seeing on this?
So it's quite, the geography is quite challenging to read, but the key thing is the ships of the English Navy is the main thing, because what this was proposing was to do for Anne to be kind of collected by the English Navy. And so as a kind of naval raid at the heart of Charles V's kind of territories to show off the power of the Navy. So you have all the kind of different ships at sea with then the kind of map working out the different things that, you know, kind of here's Calais over here, it's here's Bruges.
Yes. And I presume the little St. George must be
exactly.
England.
Yes. And, so, and this map was supposed to have left Henry marvellously inflamed. So this was the dream. It was like, great, I'm going to go and rescue my princess by sea and show off to Charles V. The Cleves delegation said no, because it was winter. They thought Anne might get ill on a sea journey, and said, no, we're going to ask Charles V for permission. We're going to come by land. We're going to cross a number of miles each day. It'll be a kind of procession. And so the second map is slightly easier to read in terms of the geography. You have kind of England in the lower right corner,
yes.
But shows the dotted line of Anne's kind of processional route to England, to get to Calais, and then to cross across to Dover. So this is the reality of what marrying Anne of Cleves is. And that kind of mismatch between the fantasy and the reality is, you know, kind of what all goes wrong in Henry's head.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. You can see him, can't you, as you say, inflamed with desire and building this idea of this, back to Henry being the romantic, chivalrous
In his mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is what allowed us to wander on to meet Catherine Howe. We've got a tiny little miniature now. There's lots of debate, isn't there?
Yes.
Going back to what you were saying at the beginning, you know, because of her execution and that her memory wasn't captured within those first 50 years, I guess we're left with lots of questions. You've gone for this particular one. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I perhaps should have said this earlier, but of course, there is a show notes page associated with this podcast, and we will have a picture of this. We've got a little miniature, and this is the portrait you've gone for. Can you explain why you've chosen this one?
Of course. So this is, I've been so bold as to say, probably Catherine Howe.
Okay.
And so this is the miniature by Holbein, of which there are two versions. So we have here the version from the Duke of Buccleuch's collection, and there's another version of the portrait in the Royal Collection. And it's clear that the sitter is royal, because the level of jewels that she's wearing, in this she has a cloth of silver dress, in the Royal Collection a cloth of gold dress, that, you know, this is the top level of jewels that she is wearing. And then the work that historians have done matching some of the jewels that she's wearing to the inventory that survives of Catherine Howard's jewels. We have a few pages of the inventory on display in the exhibition, and it's a fabulous source for kind of Catherine's sort of rise, reign and downfall, because it has all the gifts that she was showered with by Henry. Then it has the kind of annotations with gifts that she gave to Elizabeth and Mary. And then it has the list of the jewels that Henry took back after she's sent off to Sion. So in that kind of matching of the jewels, that I think it is likely to be Catherine Howard, that one of the queries sort of against it has been that idea of like, oh, why would Catherine have her miniature painted? What was the window of opportunity? And I think that in the sort of preparations perhaps for the great progress to York to meet James V of Scotland, and where there were sort of daydreams that you might all come together, that she would be pregnant, her son would be Duke of York, she would be crowned. So in the preparations for that, when there are reports as to how, you know, everybody is, all the craftspeople are making everything to be magnificent, it's highly plausible that miniatures could be created in that context. We also know that Marguerite of Navarre was kind of sending requests to try and get Catherine's portrait. She was really interested in it. So there was kind of reasons why her portrait might have been made. And there's also, in the research for this exhibition, a little bit of kind of Catherine's potential agency in this situation, and that idea of her interest in the arts and working with Holbein, because we have also on display a page of cipher designs by Holbein. And these are always, you know, incredibly complicated and impenetrable. But a number of years ago, a scholar, Vanessa Braganza, did the amazing job of decoding a large oval cipher that's in the bottom of the page, and finding the words Henricus Catherine Rex. And so that obviously raises the question of which Catherine, because there's a choice of three. And I think that it's Catherine Howard, because in the inventory of her jewels, there's a note about a collar with 16 diamonds, which has an annotation saying 10 of these diamonds set in a cipher by the Queen. And as you can see in this jewel, there are 10 stones in this cipher. And what I think is kind of really intriguing about that, that if those two pieces of evidence do tell that story, that Catherine commissioned this from Holbein, is it gives her kind of, you know, that agency and engagement with art, engagement with Holbein, and also the design of it, because Henry was giving her H's, you know, where my initial? Mm. And that thing going, oh, I'm going to commission something with my name in it, which, and her self-presentation as queen. And this is one, the jewel with, the cipher with 10 diamonds is one of the jewels that Henry takes back into his possession.
Ah, and that's recorded.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's amazing. This is a rather beautiful book. Just lighting on it briefly.
Sure. So the kind of the faint traces of Catherine as queen, because she does seem to have been deliberately forgotten. So we've got here an amazing stamped and gilt binding with KH. And the research is shown often by James Carley, great scholar of the kind of books of Henry VIII, that it's likely the timing of publication suggests that it's for Catherine Howard. What's so intriguing about this is that it doesn't necessarily give us any insight into Catherine as a person, because there are a number of books with this binding that survive, a small group, and it seems they were part of a kind of bulk commission, probably for the new library at Nonsuch Palace, so by the King's Binder, kind of luxury productions, as a treatise on the difference between royal and ecclesiastical power. When you open it, and this is one book that I have, you know, kind of handled, the pages are crisp. They do not look like they've ever been read.
Yes. Okay.
And you can imagine it sitting quietly on a bookshelf, unread for a long time, and then when it emerges again, it's no longer contentious, it's no longer dangerous.
It's already passed. But it's a beautiful binding, actually. Where does this live normally?
So this is from the British Library.
That's the British Library. Wonderful. Okay, well, that brings us on to our final section, the lovely Catherine Parr, very popular, one of Henry's consorts.
You have been listening to the first part of this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. The remainder of this episode is only available to members of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England. To join the wait list to become a member of The Ultimate Guide, click on the link in the description associated with this podcast. You will be added to the waiting list, and I will email you just as soon as the doors to the membership next reopen. I'll see you there. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!